This is Carolina Business Review. Major support provided by Colonial Life, providing benefits to employees to help them protect their families, their finances, and their futures. High Point University, the premier life skills university, focused on preparing students for the world as it is going to be. Sunoco, a global manufacturer of consumer and industrial packaging products and services, with more than 300 operations in 35 countries.
Happy holidays and Merry Christmas. Thank you for watching this program. As we head into the holiday season, will our holiday cheer turn us away from everyday business and economic concerns? But what are those things that may keep us engaged? Welcome again to the most widely watched and the longest running program on Carolina business, policy, and public affairs, seen every week across the Carolinas for more than three decades in this upcoming holiday break. Is it going to be the last pause that we have before the, and I'll call it this, the frenetic presidential election year politics? And how does the economy really unfold in the near term, meaning 2024? We will unpack some of these questions for our region, and later on, the Chief Executive Officer of U.S. BRIC, Mikey Johnson, joins us again.
Major funding also by Blue Cross Blue Shield of South Carolina, an independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association, and Martin Marietta, a leading provider of natural resource-based building materials, providing the foundation on which our communities improve and grow. On this edition of Carolina Business Review, Dr. Michael Walden from NC State University, Antoine Seawright of Blueprint Strategy, and special guest, Mikey Johnson, CEO of U.S. BRIC.
Happy holidays, Merry Christmas. Can I say Merry Christmas to you too? Is that all right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's safe here. This is a safe space.
This is a holiday space, yes.
Thank you. Michael, nice to see you again. It's been a while. Always nice to have you on, Antoine.
Thank you.
But Mike, you get the first pitch. So, Mike, there was a few weeks ago, I know we were talking about this prior to the taping, and WeWork, the co-working space that was highly touted during the pandemic, and stock was flying. It was, you know, a lot of speculation around it. Ended up filing for bankruptcy protection a few weeks ago now. And someone around that announcement, and this stuck with me, and I want to ask you this question, said that this WeWork bankruptcy filing is really more of a proxy for, and it was called the crisis in vacancy in office space. Is this a crisis, or is this a new norm of some sort?
I think I would call it maybe not as strong as a crisis, but it's a problem. And I think this problem would have manifested itself regardless of the state of the economy because of the remote work effort. 30% of workers are now working remote. And we still have construction going on. You walk around where I live in Raleigh, cranes everywhere, same in Charlotte. So there's still supply coming online. But now we have the added issue of a slowing economy. And I think all indicators are pointing to a slow economy. That doesn't necessarily mean recession, but it means demand for office space will hit a snag there. So yeah, I think that in terms of sectors that may be adversely impacted next year, especially the first half of next year, clearly commercial real estate is one of them.
Yeah, it's commercial. Go ahead, Antoine.
To my dear friend, a slowing economy is a unique term because when I think about all the normal economic measures of how we measure economic success, all pointers indicate that the economy is booming. Now, there are sectors in the economy that have shifted, and I think the pandemic was the start of that, and we're starting to see the tectonic plates moved around a good bit in terms of what's priority and what's not, and how people are conducting business in the U.S. But overall, the economic outlook looks very good. I think for not just now, but for years to come, when you think about what we have to do in order to stay globally competitive, both in the Carolinas but around the country, as relates to the workspace, look, we should have previewed this, that somehow or another traditional going into an office would change when you think about the jobs of today. And I think that may change. However, what has happened before can happen again. And so we may be in a short-term stay, but it could go back to the point where people are going back into offices, and maybe companies will think about incentivizing doing in-person workspace.
So let's zoom out from the office space for a second. Let's go back to something you said. Could this be This is not my term, and I know you've heard this, Michael. Could this be a rolling recession? Could this be not a typical recession, but felt in specific sectors at different
times? Well, let me be clear what I meant by slowdown. Slowdown, in my terminology, doesn't mean the economy is contracting. Contracting means a recession. We are still growing. All the indicators indicate employment's going up, consumer spending's going up, but it's going up at a slower pace. That's exactly what the Federal Reserve wanted to have happen in order to moderate inflation. Now, the question is, could that turn into a contraction next year? My concern is, or my forecast is, the Federal Reserve is not going to cut interest rates soon. I don't think they're going up, but they're not going to cut. As inflation goes down, and Chris, you know this, the real interest rate rises, meaning it's more expensive for people to borrow. That, I think, will put an additional stress on the economy and slow it down even more. Is that going to be a bona fide recession? I don't think necessarily, but I think first two quarters of next year are going to be much slower than they've been, and then I think we'll hit a rebound in the second half of the year when the Fed begins to cut interest rates.
Let me layer over the top of this that next year is a presidential election year, which is obviously straight in front of all of us. In presidential election years, it tends to be good for the economy, good for the capital markets. I think we know that in general. Antoine, does the presidential election year politic compound whatever could happen in the economy? Does it make it harder? Is it going to be clear it's going to be a great economy and we're going to have a good year and we may not get along on politics, but it's going to be a good year?
It could. That's making the assumption that most people going to the polls will vote on the economy. What we've seen in the past several elections, post the 2020 elections, that the economy has not been the number one indicator or the number one driver for people showing up to the polls in many battleground places. But I think slow growth, a slow and steady pace, always wins the race. And what we've seen and what we've heard from both the really, really smart people and the people at my level is that the economy was growing too fast and people were worried about this overheating. Now we're starting to see this new norm, this steady flow, and I think that's good. The one thing about the U.S. economy, it's always had the ability to take a licking and keep on ticking. So where we see slowness, I think we'll see steadiness, and I think that's good for the consumer, but it's also good for potential new opportunities that will come about as a result of the 2020 U.S. elections.
Go ahead.
I don't try to read the mind of people in terms of their voting. That's not my area, but I do think that what it's going to come down to is people's perspective and how long that perspective is. I got into a little debate with a guy named Alan Blinder in the Wall Street Journal. He's a professor at Princeton, and talking about, well, the economy looks so good. Why are people upset? And the polls do show they're upset about the economy. It's because they remember what their standard of living was in 2019 compared to today. And even though inflation is abating, in terms of the purchasing power of the average person's earnings, it's still down from what it was in 2019. So that, I think, is what has to recover for people to feel really, really good about the economy.
I certainly agree. Look, I'm frustrated too because we're having to pay more for stuff that we once enjoyed at lesser price. However, the thing about the economy, this economy in particular, is a lot of the benefits from the 2020 election, from a legislative standpoint, a lot of people cannot feel them just yet. So the short-term benefits are not felt as hard as the long-term benefits of this. So it naturally brings frustration. So when people say the economy is not doing well, the indicators say we are, but people feeling them in their everyday lives, in their everyday outlook, it's a disconnect. And I think once the long-term benefits kick in, and it may be post the 2024 election, then people will say, oh, now things are getting better.
I don't want to lead you with this question, Dr. Walden, but it feels like this time there's going to be a longer tail on the inflationary effect, that while inflation has abated, the prices still have advanced by 8, 9, 10% in some cases.
Well, I think the inflation rate for CPI is up about 17% cumulatively. Since 2021. Now, the last reading, in fact, we had a reading yesterday, there's an obscure inflation number called the PC and deflator, what economists like, came in year over year, we're only at 3%. So the inflation situation is getting better. But my point is, people's perspective, I think, is longer than what's happened in the last month. And the question for, if I can just nudge into politics a little bit, I think the question for predicting how the economy is going to read for the voter in the fall of 2024 depends upon how long people's perspective is. I actually think the economy will be improving in the second half of 2024. The question for politicians and candidates is, will that improvement overwhelm what people remember over the last 3 years?
And the real question would be for voters, are you better off than you were 4 years ago?
Isn't that always
or
the
2 years ago? That's always the economic question when it comes to, are you better off or do you see yourself feeling a little more comfortable, having a little more breathing room, as we say down south, about the economy?
Let's keep the momentum of this going with our guests. Before we do that, coming up next week on this program, manufacturing is pretty big in the Carolinas. There's no doubt about that. And a major manufacturer that you may have never heard of unless you're in the manufacturing business is a company called Domtar, headquartered in Fort Mill, South Carolina. The new CEO will be our guest. His name is Steve Henry, and he joins us next week on this program. And also, since we are talking about the economy, a couple programs we always like to do but always seem to be well watched are a two-parter, the economic review of 2023 in this case, and then the economic forecast of next year. It's two-part. It's four resident economists that like to mix it up. And I think you'll enjoy that program as well. Our guest is well-known, longtime South Carolinian, as is the company he leads. U.S. Brick, headquartered in Charleston, is exactly as its name states, manufacturing bricks and pavers for commercial and residential construction. Joining us now is the chief executive officer of one of the largest brick companies in the nation, U.S. Brick. Chief Executive Officer, Mikey Johnson. Mikey, welcome back.
Hey, Chris, how are you? Good to be here.
So you're sitting offset listening to this thing going on with this conversation about the economy. Mikey, your business is obviously cyclical. It's obviously interest rate sensitive. It's obviously closely tied to construction. When do you think you run out of room here, given this tremendous growth that we had?
Yeah, so, you know, first of all, I think about, you know, we talk about what politicians can do and this, you know, the everyday person goes to work every day and they just try to make their products and get their job done and they go home. And I think we get hung up in that because we hear about it all the time. But, you know, they want things to be as expected and be predictable. And so, like, that's what I tell my folks. I go, why are you in this business? I said, I love the fact that we make things and we make things in South Carolina. So what I tell them is, hey, look, there's certain things we control and things we don't. I certainly don't control what the Federal Reserve decides to do next week. And I don't care if you make bricks or lumber or telephone poles or all the things that are related to housing. Housing is still a huge component of GDP. It's 15 to 18% of GDP. This country needs it to be vibrant. And then I think about specifically to, you know, what we're going to see with this economic runway. People are piling into the South. It's every day I'm in one of our showrooms. Just yesterday, I had a lady who'd moved from St. Louis. They were getting out of the Midwest, wanted to move to the South. So, you know, to the dialogue between Michael and Antoine, you know, I do think that we might see some economic slowdown nationally, but the Southeastern United States, particularly the Carolinas, it feels like people are fighting to get in here every day. We have a significant housing supply shortage. Actually, I would suggest nationally, but certainly in our region. I think I see about the September number, I believe, was 3.4 months of supply. A high is maybe 5.7 or 5.8. A low might have been 1.6. So there still is housing demand nationally. Mm-hmm. So I think that runway is good, and that's a big piece of GDP, which will help. Infrastructure is obviously another huge piece of, you know, keeping people employed and making things move around this country. And if you drive anywhere around the South, we're not lacking for orange cones or Jersey barricades. So, I think there's a lot of runway, and I'm not, you know, you talk about the signals. I'm not scared where the economy's going. And sometimes as business leaders, we want things to stay the same so we know the rules, and we just operate inside the rules and let politics be what they will.
Michael, question?
Labor. Yeah. Tell me about your situation with labor. Are there enough people out there that want to work in your business? Is there a shortage? And then long run, do you foresee your industry shifting more to machinery and technology to replace people?
Yeah, so it's a great question. It also has a regional bent to it. You know, some towns are manufacturing towns. Interestingly, Columbia is not as thought of as much of a manufacturing town. So you and I were talking before, we have a facility there. So we struggle. Like, we have around 50 team members in our Columbia location, and we struggle to kind of keep all of our jobs filled in the manufacturing front. If you go to our locations in Indianapolis, West Tennessee, and, you know, just south of Birmingham, we don't really struggle for the same labor pool. school. I mean, our team members generally stay. They stay with us. And what I've also found being in the forest products industry and the brick industry, sometimes people tend to stay. And, like, sometimes you're like, at 70, it's time to retire from being in this space, you know. So sometimes we do benefit from people staying in our manufacturing facilities a long time. I've had that luxury in both spaces. But I think everybody is kind of feeling some of pressure somewhere. And you take specifically, you just take in the Carolinas, in Columbia, we have Scout Electric Vehicles about to set up shop in Columbia. I think it's 4,000 or 5,000 jobs. I don't remember the exact number. I'm not sure where they're going to find those people in Columbia. They're going to have to work. And so, you know, as kind of an indigenous manufacturer, been there a long time, of course I get excited when we see economic development in South Carolina. But I always worry, are they going to have something better to offer than what we have to offer? Mm-hmm. You know, a brand new shiny manufacturing plant can really create some opportunities. So we're feeling a little pinch in areas and certainly in the skilled trades, but overall, I think people want to work, and I think there's some dignity and pride in being in a company that makes things. So.
But do you have the ability to shift more out of labor into technology?
For sure. So I think, you know, to y'all's inflation discussion a minute ago and interest rate discussion, I mean, there's a point at which you can make it cheaper with automation than you can with manpower. And but you just have to look at, you know, it's a decision every day of balance. Do we invest in CapEx, or do we keep, you know, the guys on the line packaging the brick the way we've done it for the last 10 years, or do we automate and have two guys on the line instead of 12 guys on the line? So yeah, there definitely becomes that balance of where do you want to deploy your capital, and it really becomes a math equation at that point. But so yes, I can't imagine there are many industries that don't have robotics or automation as a platform. I think AI might do the same thing mm-hmm. to the back office, right? It may really radically change that labor front as well.
Antoine?
Nobody retires and moves up north. So we're seeing this influx of folks come to the South. But Mike, how do you stay competitive? How do you stay competitive from a wage standpoint? How do you stay competitive with all the technological advances that may pull traditional Antoine Seawrights out of the workforce and replace that with machinery? How do you make the type of work you do and your company does very successful? How do you make that attractive for a youngster who may be trying to find their why and their way?
It's funny. So it's a great question. During COVID, we never thought in manufacturing we would compete with the drive-through. You know, the fast food chains where everybody saw them, they were wrapped around the, you know, two times around, and Chick-fil-A was moving them through faster than most. But everybody, you know, we were losing manufacturing employees, you know, to the fast food industry just because they had a demand. And so we saw light, you know, and it really resonated. All the numbers we saw wages move. The nice thing about, you know, a closely held, more nimble manufacturing operation, we can move really quickly. You know, government, it takes them a long time to get wages up and to fix. I don't care if it's a teacher or a fireman or all the very essential components of our communities and our systems. As a closely held private business, we move wages, because I heard a lot of companies say, we just can't fill seats, we mm-hmm. can't get things done. Well, if your business is viable, then you're not going to let wages or you know, somebody in a seat stand in your way. You hate turnover, you hate to retrain, because there's a huge cost to that. But being you know, I mean, US Brick, we're a large, but we're an independently closely held company with a very non-layered system. So we move pretty quickly. So I don't battle some of the same issues that maybe my larger publicly traded competitors might fight. So that's an advantage for us.
Can I ask one question? Yeah, training, right? That's a big deal. Like preparation for jobs, because your jobs, I think, the plates are shifting. Those are jobs of the future now. We're making things again in the United States. So how do we train the mindset and the worker to be prepared for those jobs? Because that's not always a college degree or MBA or MHA or whatever it is.
100%. Look, my oldest, 25 years old, he's in the tech school in Horry, Georgetown, you know, studying in a trade where he can go right into the work in the wildlife and forestry management type business, because I think there is a lot of work that actually needs to get done that you don't need, you know, you don't need a political science degree from Furman to do most of the things we do in the brick business. And so, yeah, and I mean, so I think the you know, our technical school systems are incredibly powerful, both across both the Carolinas. You know, I think we're very lucky. Nobody lives further than, what, 30 minutes away from a technical school. Mm-hmm. I know in South Carolina, I don't know about North Carolina. So I think training, we're lucky as our industries, you can see, are really moving toward having resource. The Brick Industry Association offers online training and remote training. So we can deliver training in a way that we couldn't in years past. So I think it's essential, and to think that you have to have a four-year degree to go out and have a very viable livelihood and career is probably not quite the same story that it was. And I feel like I'm starting to hear that too.
Let me shift to something else, Mikey. And you're in a unique place to understand this, not just because of Cox Industries and you grew up in the South. But this past summer, and a lot of people didn't see this, Michael, you probably saw this, but Bloomberg, and I want to read this to you because I'm going to ask you a strategic question about the New South. For the first time, and this is a Bloomberg report, mm-hmm. for the first time since the government started tracking it, six southern states, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, Georgia, Florida, Texas, are contributing more to the nation's GDP than the Northeast. And then it goes on to say, the Southeast accounted for more than two-thirds of all job growth across the U.S. since early 2020. Bloomberg called it the $100 billion wealth migration, tilting the U.S. economy's center of gravity south. Now, that's statistically reported, and if that's true, and I believe it is, while we celebrate that and we have the wind at our back, don't we start to now face the same things that drove people away from that kind of growth in the Northeast and other places to begin with? And I use things like, as places like Charlotte don't want to become like Atlanta, isn't the success going to make them like Atlanta? And I don't mean just in all those places. Is that a worry for you?
Sure. I mean, we're headquartered right in downtown Charleston, and I make the drive from Columbia quite frequently to our headquarters down there. And all you got to do is get on I-26 between Columbia and Charleston to know that we're running out of room and we're running out of places to expand roads. Roads can only go so far when you're on a peninsula. And so, I think we're seeing it everywhere. Having spent a great deal of my early life in Greenville and to see the explosive growth. Greenville was a quiet little town in downtown up until about 20 years ago, and then it went bananas, right? And all the manufacturing you see that's definitely relocating to South Carolina. We're the tire capital now, the largest exporter of automobiles, and all the secondary and tertiary manufacturers mm-hmm. that are supporting all of these different, major high-end manufacturing systems. Just like Scott, I referenced a minute ago, there are a lot of people, it seems like anytime I'm on a plane flying back into Columbia, I hear somebody coming to look for a house in Blythewood. So, I think that's a reality, is that it is a good place to live, work, it's hospitable, but there's no question, I was joking with somebody driving back from Charleston last night, and I was like, at least they're working on the roads, and they go, yeah, but they're probably 10 years behind. My buddy Richard Jackson, C.R. Jackson, would say, we can't move enough, do enough, move fast enough to make the roads like we need them here in South Carolina. So, I think congestion's a problem. Then you're seeing, here again, you talk about the national housing shortage. Think about the regional housing shortage. Where are 4,000 people going to relocate to in Blythewood, South Carolina? That's a big lift in my book. And so it's a good problem for us to have as a new construction-focused company. But I definitely think we're having to get, sometimes we play checkers as it relates to how we spend our money, and it really is time for chess with all these companies coming.
That's a good way to say it. We have about 2 minutes left, Michael. You have a question.
It's 20 minutes, actually, in North Carolina to better than South Carolina.
Oh, good. Thank you.
I don't know if you can address these in a short period of time. Affordable housing, already mentioned, and global warming, two big issues anywhere in the country. Do those issues hit you, or do you have to worry about dealing with those?
Sure. Affordable housing, depending on where your locations are, we're very fortunate both in my prior life and this life. Most of our manufacturing places, our employees can live and work, our team members live and work close enough they can get to work. I do wonder how some of your larger cities that are growing faster, it's almost kind of an odd gentrification that, the guys working, the guys and gals working in our businesses every day and day out, they can't afford to live close to where they work. And so I think that's a real problem. So I think checking the box on that. But then on the environment, I think the standard at which manufacturers are held to, so I'm not attributing all of our environmental woes on manufacturing, but I know that's where it impacts me the most, is it is not a we'll do the very least amount possible to help our situation now. There's a very proactive approach to integrate, understanding what the laws are. You don't wait on the surprise visit anymore. You invite the regulators and inspectors to show you how to improve. So might not salt, look, I don't don't think U.S. BRICS going to certainly by any stretch solve global warming, but I mean, I think manufacturing and certainly our U.S.-based workforce is really focused on that in a proactive approach. So I don't know what we saw, but we see it every day in Charleston too, right? The roads get wetter faster, and it doesn't take much rain to make it drown down there. So.
30 seconds. Nikki Haley have a chance next year?
Look, she has never lost an election, and her messaging is great, and she is as good as retail politics as anybody I've ever seen or known. And I hope she works really hard and runs hard at it. So.
Saved by that we're running out of time on the show.
Amen.
But thank you. Well done. Thanks for being on the program. Nice to see you.
Good to see you again. Yeah. Good to see these guys, too.
I'm sure. Antoine, hang around. Always good to have you. Michael, stay. Glad to see you, too. Thank you for watching our program. In case I don't say it or you don't hear it enough, happy holidays, Merry Christmas. Thank you for supporting this program. We certainly hope that your family is healthy. We have a lot to say grace over, and we are grateful that you support this show and live here. Until next week, I'm Chris Wood, and we hope your weekend is good. Good night.
Gratefully acknowledging support by Martin Marietta, Blue Cross Blue Shield of South Carolina, Sunoco, High Point University, Colonial Life, and by viewers like you. Thank you. For more information, visit CarolinaBusinessReview.org.